benefits, who pays? Back to that old question again, you see.
Said Representative Dyson.
Thank you. Captain, I may have missed this, but how do we, what do we do to assure ourselves that foreign bottoms, foreign crews operating in our water are informed of their responsibilities?
Well, which responsibilities? Under the law?
For spills, hydrocarbon spills in our waters.
Okay. Well, first of all, I would have to rely, number one, on the basic safety net that you have for this IMO requirements for a vessel response plan. That's really your most rudimentary level, which identifies who you contact in case this vessel has a problem and these types of things. It doesn't require, however, that they have a qualified individual that can commit the company right away. It doesn't require that they have identified an oil spill response organization that can take care of them in the port. It doesn't do a lot of other things. It's rudimentary, it's ground floor. But that, in turn, conveys a minimal degree of recognition of what the requirements are. As long as they're international and as long as they're recognized among the nations that are in the business of shipping. Now, if you have peculiar regulations that are in excess of those in a particular state, in state waters, that are not subject to federal preemption, but are augmentation on the level of risk management, those types of things. Well, those types of regulations needs to be conveyed to the vessel representative as a condition of coming into your port. And our port, port state control authority under the Coast Guard has regular inspections of these vessels when they come in. Sometimes you hear about vessels being held and not being able to get underway, these types of things. It's because they violate certain federal regulations or international regulations associated with safety of life at sea or MARPOL or these types of things, or it's deemed a threat to the public or a threat to the environment or perhaps endangering the crew, and we will not let them go. So we have an enforcement mechanism and indeed an education mechanism in the captain of the port inspections as these vessels come in.
Follow up, please.
So it's only related to if they're going to be docking in some of our ports?
That's right.
Second question on a different line. Mm-hmm. What's the policy and decision mechanism you go through and when a Coast Guard cutter is responding to a vessel in distress, whether to tow or not? When do you tow them and when do you say, go get yourself a commercial towboat?
Well, that's a question that there isn't a direct answer on, but maybe I can satisfy it. We depend first and foremost upon the operational judgment of our commanding officer on scene. And if you're in an extremist situation where he judges because of the safety of life at sea considerations that is necessary to affect a tow situation, and also judges that he will not be putting his own vessel in undue danger, and by doing so, he will affect a tow situation at that time. Now, on the other hand, if in his judgment and the judgment of the district command center, which is in communication with him in these types of situations, and the district commander is in communications in this situation, if there is an option for a commercial tower to be, or solver to be able to come in lieu of the Coast Guard, and if in the judgment that this is a reasonable and prudent course of action from a safety perspective, that is our preference, to go commercial rather than tow them ourselves. That is commandant policy.
Last question. Yeah, when we run into a situation like the vessel out at Dutch, how quickly can, I'll say this awkwardly, mm-hmm. if the vessel operator and owners are not responding quickly to the situation, which I think is the case there, how quickly can we get decisions to take over that and preempt the spill containment?
Oh, that can be done very quickly, sir. It's
hours?
That authority is given and delegated to the federal on-scene coordinator, who in this particular case was the commanding officer of the Marine Safety Office at Anchorage. He's an 06, he's a captain like myself. His name was Ed Thompson in this particular case. And whoever that FOSC is, the National Response Plan conveys that authority to that person in the field to make the determination whether that contractor is being responsive or not. And it's a tough decision, it really is, but it involves a lot of consequences. They try to be fair, they try to give their best decision on it. Now, let me say this, it's my understanding the Kiroshima situation was a little, not quite as black and white as that. We had a responsible party in the Kiroshima. The problem with the Kiroshima, some said in looking at the report, was it was difficult to get a qualified individual rapidly to the beginning of the game. A qualified individual being somebody that can make contractual arrangements with your oil spill response organization to take care of the situation. In lieu of that, the federal on-scene coordinator, recognizing the fact that he had a viable company, yes, it was a Japanese company, they had been in contact with them, but they're having a problem with the qualified individual. The federal on-scene coordinator made the decision, he talked to the potential oil spill response organization that had the response capability out there at Dutch. And he said to them, look, I know they don't have a qualified individual. If they turn out to be irresponsible, I will back you with the Federal Oil Spill Trust Fund. You know I have that backing me. And so what I'm telling you is that I expect you to do what you think is the right thing for Alaska. And be assured that we will hold the responsible party's feet to the fire. But he recognized he was in a gray area there, and he chose not to declare the owner of the Kiroshima as irresponsible, because indeed he wasn't. Indeed he came through, and albeit it wasn't a nice clean situation between him and the oil spill response organization ultimately, but he came through.
So my main concern there is the time. How long did it take between the time that the you were dealing with the owner, mm-hmm. and say get going, and you finally preempted and told the contractor get going anyways?
I do not know the answer to that. It's my understanding that there was not very much delay at all. In that situation, and I do not know in terms of hours. And if I were going to put it in perspective to other oil spills with similar logistics challenges, I would say it was inconsequential. And, it was, and thanks to the good judgment and the experience of Captain Ed Thompson, who was one of the most experienced federal on-scene coordinators we had in the Coast Guard. He's with BP now.
Okay, thank you. Representative Smalley, and then that will finish our questions.
I guess it's for clarification and understanding on my part, and then some observations, some comments that you made with perhaps a question wrapped in. Mm-hmm. When we're in reference to the State Oil Response Trust Fund and the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, mm-hmm. we're talking about monies. Is this the nickel assessment with what goes through the pipeline?
States.
All right, the states. And
there's also a barrel tax imposed on the oil industry that goes into the federal oil spill trust.
And when the decision is made to respond to, say, an orphan spill or the spill such as out on the chain, and you have parties that are not part of the payment plan, the responsible plan, and there's assessment, how long does it take to get this recovery of funds back into the fund, and when they don't come back in, is it my question, I guess it's a comment, it'd almost be a perceived penalty to to those companies that are paying the bucks.
Sure, I'm sure it's perceived that way. Absolutely.
And what is the rate of recovery from those individuals that are responsible but not part of the trust fund?
For which trust fund?
Collecting the money back. Well, the ones that would
the
be
federal
assessed.
Or the state?
Either.
If you could ask Mr. Dietrich, as far as the state goes, that would probably be a quicker way of getting your answer.
Okay.
I do not know on the federal our current rate of success is. But it's a moving target. So. And suffice it to say, if it ever drops below a certain level, well, the money spigot is turned back on. And ultimately, we all pay for that when we pull our car up to the gas pump, I'm
okay.
told. But the mechanism for replenishment is there. I think that's the important consideration as far as the federal trust fund goes. Yes.
Thank you.
Captain Egan, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Well presented and well answered.
It's a pleasure talking to all of you. Thank you.
Thanks again. Mr. Dietrich, if you could join us, please. Make your presentation, and we'll hold our questions until the end.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome.
You said something about time. I prepared some remarks. It's a broad spill response overview in response to what we expected you wanted today. I suspect I'll take about 10 minutes if that's still within.
Fine, please.
Okay. For the record, my name is Larry Dietrich, and I currently act as the Director of the Spill Prevention and Response Division for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. We have developed over the years some degree of expertise within the division on spill response matters, and I'd like to thank you for inviting me before the committee and welcome the opportunity to act as a resource for you to research any issues that you would like to have researched. We look forward to working with the committee, and if we can in any way be of assistance in getting you information, we'd be pleased to do that. Alaska has gone a long way to improve the safe handling, storage, and transportation of oil and chemical resources on which the state and its citizens are dependent. Significant accomplishments have been made. As a result of the changes made in law by the legislature following the 1989 spill, we can now say that we are better, safer, and in some areas, we believe the best in the world. This could not have been done without the participation and cooperation of industry, the public, special interest groups such as the Regional Citizens Advisory Groups in Prince William Sound and Cook Inlet, Alaska Spill Cooperatives, the Response Action Contractors, local, state, and federal agencies, and the support of the legislature. In short, it's been a concerted effort on the part of many to take meaningful steps to prevent spills and improve our preparedness and ability to respond. These stakeholders have been committed to doing it right, and we have, as a result, now achieved what we believe to be tangible results. We have a number of examples that we can provide the committee at a later time, should you be interested. There are, of course, areas where improvements have yet to be made, in our opinion. These need further work, and the need to remain vigilant is paramount as the infrastructure for some portions of our production, storage, and transportation system ages. The department is responsible for protecting Alaska's land, waters, and air from oil and hazardous substance spills. The division strives to implement this mandate in a way that provides a stable and credible regime for the regulated community while enhancing the health and general welfare of the people and protecting the environment. The division is responsible for preventing, preparing, and responding to the release of all oil and hazardous substances. In the event of spills or releases, the division responds to ensure the safety of those involved, those responding, or those exposed. We ensure the protection of public health from the direct or indirect effects of contamination of our air, water, and food. We also have an objective to protect the natural and cultural resources and biota from the direct and indirect effects. We also take steps to ensure the containment, control, cleanup, and disposal, as well as restoration. And last but not least, we seek to recover costs of the spill back to the state. We will never totally eliminate the risk of another spill, but we are better at managing the risk now. Although oil spill cleanup is a very difficult and imperfect business, impacts and damages can be minimized and the total cleanup costs lowered with an effective response. Effective spill response requires partnerships. In larger spills, the resources of all players are needed. Partnerships, for example, are needed to track oil using simple visual observation from fishermen and boats to technical experts now who can track oil with sophisticated satellite imagery. Resource experts are needed to develop cleanup strategies and tactics to recover oil and protect environmentally sensitive areas. Logistical support requirements for cleanup efforts in remote locations are an enormous undertaking because of the huge size of the state, diverse habitats, and extensive coastline. The heavy lift capability of both the private and military sectors are frequently needed. Involvement of local resources is critical to an initial first response. In very large or catastrophic spills, there is no single organization that has all of the assets or resources needed for a complex response. It takes the combined assets and resources of all involved. This requires partnerships between all of the stakeholders in Alaska. For partnerships to be effective, they must start early. You do not want to wait to form relationships until the spill occurs. This is particularly true in the response business. There are other substantial benefits to forming and maintaining the relationships early on. They can be effectively used to devise ways to prevent spills, as well as to jointly train, drill, and maintain the readiness needed to be able to effectively respond when a spill does occur. The progress that has been made to date can largely be attributed to the complex array of partnership relationships that have been forged in Alaska over the past years. Alaska's spill response network has greatly matured. All parties now work to the same common objectives once a spill occurs. We now operate under a shoot first or respond now, worry later philosophy. Alaska's industry is very responsible, and the idea of them not responding is virtually a thing of the past. A combined effort to contain, control, and clean up a spill is the best way to mitigate impacts and keep costs down, particularly in a world where costs for natural resource damages can frequently outstrip the cost of the response itself. So how does the system work in Alaska? Alaska law is similar to federal law and the law of most other oil-producing states. Under this legal framework, the spiller is responsible for cleanup and costs. In other words, it's the spiller pays principle. Under the law, there's a clause known as the duty to respond. This places the burden on the spiller to clean up the spill. As a result, the spiller is in direct charge of the cleanup and implements his spill contingency plan if he has a facility or vessel that is required to have one. Only certain facilities which store or transport larger quantities of oil and thus pose a bigger spill threat have the additional responsibility of preparing a contingency plan. The division's responsibility under the law is to oversee the cleanup and augment or take over cleanup when it is inadequate. Various federal government agencies also have a similar role under federal law. Under this scheme, the costs for response and cleanup are ultimately borne by the spiller, and funds spent by the state from the response account are restored. This self-sustaining concept for recovering response costs has been operating in Alaska now for well over a decade. This legal scheme is carried out during the response for the use of the incident command system. Under this system, a unified command consisting of the incident commander for the spiller and the state and federal on-scene coordinators is used to develop a single set of incident objectives which guides how the response is managed. And although takeovers are largely a thing of the past, there are not many medium or large-scale events where state resources are not used to augment the cleanup. Under the Unified Command, any state resources can be made available to augment the cleanup through the State On-Scene Coordinator. State On-Scene Coordinator is the incident commander and person in charge for the state. He has pre-delegated authority to spend an immediate $25,000, can verbally request additional amounts from the state response account through the division director up to the full amount available. He may also access whatever state resources may be beneficial to expediting the response. He comes equipped with numerous in-place partnerships, including multi-agency mutual aid agreements, term contractors, emergency contracting authority, interstate agreements, local response agreements, spill response equipment, and communication systems. There are three state on-scene coordinators designated for Alaska for the northern, south central, and southeast areas. Each is responsible for the initial response in their respective areas. For larger spills, team members from many of the areas may be brought in to assist. Additional backup is also sought from other state agencies, term contractors, and local communities. It is the same state on-scene coordinator is also responsible for responding on a daily basis to the numerous small and medium-sized spills or potential spills that occur throughout Alaska. A good recent example of a potentially serious spill was the incident involving the Chesapeake trader last weekend. Fortunately, the volume of oil loss was not significant. The vessel was, however, laden with crude and presented the most serious of our catastrophic spill scenarios, a laden crude oil tanker in marine waters. It is also a reminder of the high risk posed by the incredibly tough Alaska environment and the need to be vigilant and prepared. Ice in Cook Inlet at the time was ranging up to 3 feet thick, and extremely high winds have hampered loading operations in Valdez this week. Another example of some of the things that have to be dealt with and monitored on a continuous basis. The response in the case of the Chesapeake Trader worked very well, again, largely to the partnerships which have been put in place for spill response in Alaska. In this case, Cook Inlet Spill Prevention and Response, the Spill Cooperative for Cook Inlet, responded on behalf of one of Alaska's major companies who was working with the state and federal on-scene coordinator in the Unified Command. Another improvement is our effort to provide real-time communications. We have found that one of the biggest challenges in a complex response is the need to communicate to you and other stakeholders what is happening on a real-time basis. We have developed situation reports to do this and have tried hard to immediately get these to anyone who we anticipate may want to know. We found that when people are not informed, they assume the worst. When they are informed, they tend to provide helpful comments and suggestions. We expanded on this notion for the Kirishima spill when, for the first time nationwide, we believe, we posted information for the event on our website and updated it daily. Use of this technology is another improvement and has greatly expanded our ability to inform those who want to know at a greatly reduced cost to the response. We estimate this approach saved individually handling as many as 1,000 inquiries, which would otherwise bog down the command operations during the Kirishima response. I would also note the ongoing spill currently going on in Coos Bay, Oregon, and note that there's also a website, in case you haven't seen it, for that one. And the similarities between this incident and the Kirishima spill, which occurred in Dutch Harbor, are uncanny. And another reminder of the spill risk that still exists. The ship is literally, it's a Japanese freighter. It's positioned about the same orientation on the shore. It's being pounded by surf. I'd encourage you to look at those photos. And I didn't bring the website, but I'll get that for you if you would like to have it. Small spills are sometimes more problematic than larger spills. Orphan drums, for example, are a particular concern because of their prevalence and unknown contents. In some cases, they pose a serious threat to public health or the environment and cannot, as a result, be ignored. Although not serious from a volume standpoint, they may contain materials that can cause injury and therefore, if unknown, must be secured, characterized, and disposed accordingly. Still, other responses may be to clandestine drug labs, which can be a pea soup of dangerous chemicals. The variety and type of responses is great, and no two spills are alike. Planning for response has also improved. Response management using the Incident Command System is guided by the National Contingency Plan, State Federal Unified Plan, and local response plans. In addition, sub-area plans are being prepared for each of 10 different areas in Alaska. Efforts are also now underway to prepare geographic replans in certain high-risk areas. These government contingency plans are complemented by facility or vessel-specific response plans. The sum total of these planning efforts is to provide for a single integrated response that can take advantage of any of the resources or assets included in all of the plans. Other efforts have been completed to map where the primary chemical hazards are in Alaska. This was done through a statewide hazards analysis in 1995. The information from this is used by local communities to prepare the hazmat portion of their local response plans. In addition, we now have two landmark agreements in place with the Anchorage and Fairbanks hazmat teams, whereby they may be activated by the state on-scene coordinator to respond outside of their jurisdiction to a hazmat release anywhere in Alaska. They may also be activated to assist industry through the state on-scene coordinator upon request, giving industries like the Alaska Railroad the ability to use a resource they might not otherwise be able to access. This provides all Alaskan communities with the ability to call for assistance from our two most sophisticated fire departments. It is these kinds of partnerships where Alaskans can share Alaskan response resources by being an extension of the state's response capability. It's a need for continuous improvements in what we do. I hope this gives you some feel for the nature of spill response in Alaska. We encounter an incredibly diverse array of circumstances ranging from the small to the catastrophic, and could not get the work done without the cooperation of those in the business we work with. There's more to tell, but this concludes my prepared overview remarks, and again, we'd be happy to address any questions and look forward to assisting the committee in its work. I would just highlight, we did include some passouts in your packets. The line book, there's been a lot of talk about the incident command system. I thought if we brought one so you could touch it and feel it and see it, that it might give it meaning. This is the command structure when you hear folks referring to the incident command system. This is the most current model. We are currently on an industry ad hoc work group to capture the different things, improvements to the system that have been made by Alaska Clean Seas, by our separate operators, are all captured in here. This will continue to develop over the years, but when they say incident command, you want to know this is the organizational structure that we all use. The other items here, there's a sit rep from the Chesapeake Trader. They're getting more sophisticated. We do try to get these to all the legislators. I don't know how they've been working. You can grade us on that. We're adding location maps, and with again, with the technology we have now, we try to get the digital photos in so you have firsthand information. There's an update sheet on the Coos Bay, so you can make your comparison with the Kuroshima. I think a special recognition to SERVs, Alyeska, and our crude oil producers. There's a sheet here in preparation for some events coming up next month, comparing 1989 to 1999, and this sheet kind of does that. These next three sheets on these vessels, I think, represent the commitment that's being made by industry. These are some of the three state-of-the-art vessels that are coming online. The first one is the Enhanced Tractor Tug, which was christened on February 3rd. The second one is called a Prevention Response Tug, for which delivery has not yet been taken, but which is the second generation of new tugs for Prince William Sound. The third one is North Slope, where an enhanced capability to respond in broken ice. Again, another indication of the commitment by industry and the cooperation we've been getting in terms of building the response capability. These last three brochures simply are brochures that we use to describe the state's role, how a statewide hazmat capability is developed, and how we try to bring local communities in as part of the state's response capability through local response agreements, thereby giving us the ability to use their resources and reimburse them for their costs. And that concludes my remarks, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Dietrich. I'm sure we do have questions. I have a couple to start off with, if I might. Rather than look at the broad range of your responsibilities, if you could keep my questions in the context of the marine transport of petrochemicals, either for usage as bunker and or crude oil being shipped. Could you, in five words or less,
okay,
feel free to use 10, that would be fine, characterize your department's relationship with the oil industry?
I think the partnership, the number of work groups and whatnot we've been involved with in the industry, in my experience, and I've been banging around since the 70s on working with the oil industry, is probably as high as I've ever seen it, and that's in some 20 to 25 years of experience working with them. It's been very good, and the partnership, particularly on the oil spill response capability, the theme of doing it right, it has all been a driving force to, it's kind of pushed us together with local communities, regional citizens advisory groups to get these enhancements. I don't think you could have seen these enhancements that we're talking about now, which are very substantial in previous times. So I think that is an indicator of what's shown. It's not without its bumps and pushing and pulling. Certainly that occurs, but certainly, I think the landmark achievements, some of them have been made now as a result of work over the last two, three, 4 years we're starting to see tangible results now.
Good. Previous times being pre-1989?
Yeah, the 80s were rougher. Definitely.
Yeah, so
there was a surge right after the spill, and a lot of clamoring as the new legislation come online and the response fund, and It just takes there, you got to overcome that inertia before you can actually start producing results. And so I think we're starting to see some of the results, really, that they're a long time coming, but I think they're getting online here finally.
Would it be fair to characterize then your assessment as satisfactory progress?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
Okay. You mentioned the full amount available in the spill response account.
Mm-hmm.
Just roughly, what is that full amount?
The state spill response account has $50 million, and that was, it initially started out in the legislation as the nickel barrel attacks, and I believe it was 95. It went to the 2-cent, 3-cent split. The 2-cent was earmarked to fill up the $50 million account. When it hits the $50 million mark, the tax switched off. And so the 2-cent tax is currently switched off, the account is full, and it's available for use.
Mr. Chairman, just on that point, that was a statutory change that the legislature put in place to make sure that at the $50 billion it stayed there, that it didn't just grow and grow and grow and grow and there be no controls on it. We statutorily did that on purpose.
Sure. I understood. Thank you, Representative.
It's worked very well.
Okay. Recognizing that the spill of 1989 had a cost in excess of billions, how comfortable are you with the $50 million number? Is it adequate?
Mr. Chairman, were you to compare it to the total state cleanup bill in 1989, I think the total state cleanup bill came in at around $125 to $150 million by comparison. So certainly another spill on that scale, it could be exceeded again, but I think it's an appropriate amount to jumpstart anything that we might experience. Certainly, I think it's appropriate that if we're going to exceed $50 million that we come back to the legislature to get your approval.
Sure. And by inference, I was not making the point that perhaps that might not be adequate. I was merely asking the question for your opinion.
Yeah, the amount of money makes me nervous. I mean, it's the amount of money that we're spending that amount. I'm very comfortable seeking additional approvals.
So, your authority is that which is required to spend the $50 million. That's correct. The responsibility and the authority. Is that correct?
Okay. Yes, the department has delegated responsibility under the statute to manage the response fund.
And we said when you refer to the department,
it's the commissioner. It's to the commissioner who is delegated to the division director.
Okay.
And that's not without controls. Anytime we access that $50 million account, we are required by statute to notify Representative Phillips now this year and the governor's office by memo.
Mm-hmm.
So each time we crack into that, we have to let you know within 120 hours of doing so.
Okay. Representative Phillips.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Dietrich, I thought your comments were very good. And Mr. Chairman, I would like to have copies of his comments for all of us, please, to have. I do have one question, and that is, what is the state's position and expertise and preparedness right now for in situ burning when that might be the ideal response for us to make? And I know a lot of work, there was a lot of exploration, yes, a lot of testing done after 89.
Through the chair, Representative Phillips, in situ burning, I kind of like to think in situ burning is another tool that was pioneered in Alaska. And the reason that I say that, I have participated in in situ burns. The work originally was pioneered up here on the North Slope by industry as a broken ice oil spill response recovery technique. Mechanical recovery, as you can well imagine, in broken ice is very difficult. There's been open burn burn tests conducted. I would have to check back. I think the first one I attended was in the 70s. We have used the tool in Alaska. More recently, we have actually formalized in situ burn guidelines. First edition that was approved by the Alaskan Regional Response Team came out in 1994. They are currently undergoing revision and are out to public notice as we speak. I think we have a very good understanding now of the impacts of the smoke on public health. And the basic guidelines in Alaska now, when you're making the decision, and the decision is made by the state on-scene coordinator and the federal on-scene coordinator in the unified command, so there's no more, you don't have to go another agency to get the approval because it's all been delegated down to the command post. Wildlife considerations are no longer taken into account. In the development of these guidelines, we consult with Fish and Wildlife Service, Fish and Game, and they are all willing to accept the consequences of the impacts of black smoke on wildlife versus crude oil on oiled shorelines on wildlife. So that basic trade-off. So when we issue burn permits for burning now, there's one primary reason that we do so, and that's to protect fundamental public health. And we've now, I think, have very good safe distances that are in these guidelines that are out to public notice now that the on-scene coordinators can use to make sure public health is protected should they decide to conduct a burn. Beyond that, the decisions to burn is largely one of a tactical call. And this was a good discussion earlier this morning on the new Carissa. Burning outside a ship is a whole different ball game than burning inside a vessel. Outside a ship, oil on water, we got fireproof boom, we got tow boats, we got incendiary devices, we got helitorches, we know how to ignite it, we know the parameters that you have to be within in terms of oil thickness, sea state, and winds to be able to actually conduct a burn, ignite and sustain a burn. We have attempted to burn, and we were chatting this morning, I think there were some actual burns in vessels in the Aleutians back in the 80s. We're doing some research on that now, but I myself have been involved with a Crowley barge at Hinchinbrook entrance that lost its tow. It was refined products. We were afraid it was going to flounder. Unified Command, we actually consult with Department of Defense. And usually the options are you go with the Air Force and a missile, okay, or you go with the Navy SEALs and you use planted explosive devices. I'm not an expert in this arena, but it's a tactical call here. What you basically have to do is you have to get the product out of the cargo tanks, and you have to get it spread out and exposed to air to combust an appreciable quantity of it. So if you got a bunch of cargo tanks, you hit it with a missile, you have to talk to the experts that know that to see if they can. The missiles aren't as certain to open up every cargo tank as dropping some Navy SEAL guys down on the deck, planting charges at the appropriate location and then detonating them. In that particular case, we actually had those folks were pre-staged in Cordova for that particular event, and then they caught the hook right before we had a problem, weren't activated. That's probably the same thing they're going through at Coos Bay now. The problem is these fuel tanks are buried under the bottom of the boat, so they're below the cargo compartments, and the access is difficult. Kirishima was interesting. Again, it was parallel to the shore, getting pounded on the outside. The technique there was to open a hole right in the side of the vessel, actually torched a hole to access the top of the fuel tanks. And in that case, we went with lightering. Portable tanks were brought to the shoreline, and a lightering program was set up where you actually take suction using a Desme skimmer out of the fuel tank, pump it to shore. I don't know all the circumstances down there. I'm sure lightering was considered. I think this thing's been floundering about, it's been about a week or so. But you got a rocking ship. Bunker generally has to be preheated to around 170 degrees. I mean, they actually have heating coils that you have to heat this stuff up before it can even be used as a fuel on board. It's very thick. All the volatiles are gone. It doesn't ignite well. You usually have to enhance it. We even, for the Kirishima, it had to be cut with diesel to get it to flow. So it's, they're tough decisions. And if this, what I understand, New Carissa is they've determined that if they pull it offshore, unlike the Kirishima, that if they do get it off the shore, and I don't see that would be any easier than it would be for the Kirishima, which took 2 months and two salvors before that was successful, that it will sink. So I think, whereas we thought the odds of lightering, you know, pulling it off would be successful and the ship would be intact, it sounds to me like the situation down there is if they pull it off, the ship has been damaged enough that it won't float. So they're left with the alternative of having to deal with it in the surf. So it's a tough circumstance. And I understand they did use the seals and explosive devices on the five tanks didn't get ignited. Again, you got to get air into it, and they might be trying again.
Okay, if we can move along, Representative Small.
I think I heard the answer to the question I had about the success rate of recovery of funds, which was fairly high. The other thing would be, do you have an idea what the amount of non-recoverable funds has been over, say, the last 5 years? Mm-hmm. And when recovered funds come in, they go back to replenish the $50 million? Is that where they go?
That's generally correct. Representative Smalley, through the chair, the recovered funds are returned to the mitigation account, mm-hmm. and then it's up to the legislature then to appropriate them back into the response. And I would say, on average, our recovery rate, because of the legal wrangling that sometimes goes on, generally it takes anywhere from 1 to 3 years to complete a recovery. And our rates are included annually in a report that's required by statute to the legislature. The actual accounting on the fund is provided.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Bryce.
Okay, we have the 470 fund. We have the nickel a barrel tax split in 2 and 3. The 2 is cut off because we've reached the $50 million. Could you explain a bit about what the 3 cent tax is for?
Representative Bryce, through the chair. The 3 cent was intended when they made the 2 cent, 3 cent split, and you look in the statutes, there's actually two purposes now. There's purposes set forth for how funds from the response account can be used, and the statute sets forth then the purposes for which funds from the prevention account can be used. And the things that the prevention account can be used for are these smaller events. There was a distinction made in the drafting there that the response account is for what they call imminent and substantial threats. I think the intent here is that it is for our bigger situations. But then we had these orphan drum problems.
That's right.
And we don't like to be tapping the response account, the $50 million account, to take care of maybe a $3,000 orphan drum problem, which we run into on a daily basis. So it can also be used for that purpose, the prevention account. So the prevention account we use for those smaller situations, as well as preparedness, training, drills, contingency plan review, and a host of other things that are included there.
And to follow up on that, Mr. Chair, if I can.
Go ahead, please.
In terms of being prepared in the training and everything else, how was an Alaska Dutch able to, how well did the community respond? Not necessarily Chideau, but the community itself respond to the Kirishima incident?
Representative Bryce.
Because of those funds.
Yeah, through the chair. The community out there, the initial response by the locals was outstanding. The first people there was we have a DEC and Coast Guard people stationed in Dutch Harbor who responded immediately along with the locals. When you're at that beginning part of an event, the locals just took charge. We were very fortunate with the Kirishima that we had road access to where the freighter was located. And their initial actions were to dam the outlet to Summer Lake, and first they dealt with the rescue was the first priority and objective. The second objective was to dam the outlet to Summer Lake to prevent the bunker from getting up there. But that initial night, the conditions were severe. But the locals did a fantastic job.
Yes.
And one last one. In terms of the two cent tax on the barrel that goes directly into the $50 million. When that $50 million is spent down, say, give me two scenarios. One, by an organization that, you know, pays into that, and then an organization that does not pay into that. If that 470 fund is spent down, does that 2 cent tax automatically start up again, or do you go after settlement and through the civil process, or how do you replenish the simply speaking, how would you replenish the 470 fund?
Representative Bryce, through the chair, the mechanism for replenishment, if we open up the account, mm-hmm. and we go into the $50 million and the balance, well, first of all, the balance is calculated by Department of Revenue and Administration is calculated mm-hmm. quarterly. Okay, so the balance, the actual accounting technique, as I understand it, is determined when they make that determination, which I think is at the end of the quarter. So if at that point, the balance is below $50 million, the tax switches back on.
Okay.
And the tax, therefore, would stay on for a minimum of an additional quarter. And if enough, if the tax generated during that a quarter enough to bring it back up over 50, then at the end of the following quarter, mm-hmm. it would switch back off. The cost recovery is separate and apart from that. In the meantime, then, at the Kurashima, we opened up the account. The settlement on the Kurashima is not quite complete yet. They have been very responsible. We don't anticipate problems, but the money that we recover from them then will go into the mitigation account. And then the legislature chooses then where to appropriate that, either to prevention or response account. If it's still above 50 historically, then they've appropriated into the prevention account.
And do you make a differentiation between expenses, say, for an organization that you guys have had to spend money on that pays into the 470 fund directly, say, one of the three big producers, or not? I mean, obviously, Kurashima was, and those types of vessels do not put anything into the 470 fund. And say an Exxon tanker does, or a BP tanker, or Narco tanker does. Does the department look at whether or not the organization contributes to the 470 fund in terms of how they go after replenishment?
Yes, Representative Bryce, through the chair. The way the statute is constructed, it allows the fund to be used for any oil or hazardous substance spill, regardless of whether or not the spiller had contributed to that or not.
Go ahead.
Representative Kemplin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned about contingency plans in high-risk areas.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you at in developing those?
Representative Kemplin, through the chair. There's planning. Let me see. There's planning that's required by certain regulated facilities and industry, and there's a planning burden put on them. And then as well as the government has a suite of plans under the National Kinsey Plan and state law that we're required to prepare. So if you start out from a facility and grow up, and I have some information I could get to the committee on this, you might think of it as in terms of a facility, say a bulk storage facility in Cook Inlet would initially have a plan specific to that facility that would be prepared that basically says then on a bigger regional basis how resources are mobilized, not just within this on the facility premises, but then within that whole region. The next tier up then would be the state federal unified plan then, which is a plan that guides then how to mobilize resources from anywhere in the state to that area. So it's a tiered thing. We are working on ways to improve the efficiency of that planning. It's not necessarily as streamlined as it could or should be, and there's a number of things being done in that arena right now. But yeah, there are a large number of plans. The idea is that they're all integrated and work together, but it is a real burden to get all of these done.
Mm. Okay, so these, so it seems to me that there's this sort of integrated set of contingency plans. It's such a goal to be strived for then.
Yes.
Okay, it's a work in progress. That's what I'm hearing from
yes.
you. Okay. It kind of gets back to this, some questions that I asked the captain here about comments that he had made in terms of an increasing resource gap between a community's, you know, perception of risk from vessels and their ability to fund preparations for that risk. And in his comments also, the captain mentioned that when they do exercises, that community resources to participate in exercises are extremely limited. So, and I hear you talking in your explanation about the oil spill response account, for that there is a response and component to it, and there's also a prevention component to it also. And that prevention component does pay for preparedness. So the question to you then is, can these funds be used to pay for exercises for participation in these by local communities, and also can that these funds be used to pay for the forward placement of mechanical equipment in high risk areas? That from what I've heard so far, seems to be an area that needs to be addressed.
Yes, Representative Kemplin, through the chair. Yeah, those are good points. Our approach, we think it's critical. Local communities have local resources, they have local knowledge, they have local fishermen, they've got local fishing boats, and they cannot be left. They're a key ingredient to any response. Number one, they're the first responders. So it's our goal over time to bring local communities in as part of the state response network. And we do that with what we call local response agreements. That's how those hazmat agreements work with Anchorage and Fairbanks work. It does two things for us. One, it allows us, when a spill occurs, to activate whatever local resources the locals want to make available for the event. That activation is through the state on-scene coordinator, and when they turn those resources on, they then become part of the state response, and we will reimburse that community for whatever those costs are for participating. Mm-hmm. It could be anything from, we need a phone line and a desk, to we need your dozers or your harbor boat or whatever the asset is that might be appropriate to help take care of the situation. So the response costs are covered, and we then go seek recovery costs from the spiller.
Mm-hmm.
We reimburse the community, and then it's our burden to get the money back from the spiller and restore it back to the account. The preparedness costs now. Having the local response agreement in place then allows that. That's also the vehicle we use then to train, drill, prepare, and provide equipment. And the way we have done that. We have equipment packages that'll be in that one brochure now. We have pre-positioned equipment in a number of different local areas, and we do that on a very methodical basis, because in any given area, we don't want to buy equipment if industry has it in their pile over here, if the Coast Guard has it in this pile. So we work one-on-one with the local community. We determine what it is, the equipment item is, that's most advantageous to them to participate in a response, and then we seek to procure that for them. And we have done that in the locations shown in the brochures, within the limits of the available money and the 3 cent too. I mean, that's the other.
Okay.
It's not enough. I mean, we still have to stay within that prevention account budget.
Indeed, but I guess the question is, this notion of being able to, you said that you pre-stationed the equipment. Question is, you know, is that equipment that you've pre-stationed, is it adequate to meet the concerns of communities in terms of their perception of risk from oil spills? And is this pre-placement of equipment that is out there now, is there a plan as part of your contingency plan? Are you programming funds for additional placement, forward placement of equipment to meet the optimum contingency scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, to rephrase, is one, how much equipment is out there now? And two, is it adequate to meet the needs of the for the oil spill response, and what has been said is the communities increasing perception of risk, and two, does the department, does DEC have in their as part of their contingency plan, do they have a schedule for increasing the placement, the forward placement of mechanical equipment out there?
Representative Kempton, through the chair. Yes, by way of an example, the, for example, in Western Alaska, number one, the equipment that we, again, we work with communities who, for whom we have entered into a local response agreement. We have to have interest at the other end there to do this. So the ones that have stepped forward and we're working with, the number one thing we do is we target the risk. So if you're in rural Alaska, we're not talking about catastrophic crude oil spills. We're talking about usually refined product spills from bulk fuel storage facilities that are generally problematic out there. We also take a look at what the community has in the way of a response organization. Some communities are very sophisticated. In other communities, the target may be to get 40-hour HAZWOPER training to that community. We've generally been using connexes then, and so the connexes that we pre-position out there will include the type of materials then to deal with the risk that we face in that community that is not already provided for by that facility if they are regulated, or by another state or federal agency if they have equipment there. So the kind of gear you'll see in our connexes in the remote towns in Western Alaska is going to be things like sorbent pads, fast tanks, shovels, things that are generally used for refined product spills to land. In some cases, we will include boom if there's a waterway nearby, which would demand that some boom also be available there. So yeah, we try to target the equipment for what the community can handle and for the type of risk that is posed in that area.
Okay, if we can stop it there, Mr. Kempton, I'm sure that Mr. Dietrich is available to you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
You're most welcome, thank you. Mr. Dietrich, thank you.
Thank you.
The real question before the committee was, is there an adequate response plan in place? I, for one, can say that I'm comfortable that there is, and we'll leave it at that. The question has been answered, and thank you very much, and thank Captain Egan very much.
Appreciate it.
I understand. So,
and he's a
No, yeah, there seems to be. It seems to be a gap, though.
586-19.
Well, I don't think it's perfect, and I don't think they I think they recognize that it's not. But it's where they've made progress.
Indeed. And I'm the first one to state that they have made progress. And I'm very impressed with the industry response with those new vessels. It's a huge contribution to improving our ability to deal with these type of issues. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
If you need anything, just give us a holler and we'll try to get off quickly.
Sure.
Excuse me. You want me to fax them or you want an original?
You can fax them, it's fine.
Okay.
My number's on the card. Okay. Yes, here we go.
Thank you, Representative Kim. Those good questions. I'm not sure if I did a good job there on your last question there.
Well, the key question for that
I didn't get
in terms of an answer.
I don't know.
I knew you had problems, but I was taking.